88.9 FM in Irvine, bowling you over with good music since 1969.
You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. This is Subversity Show with Dan Zhang. Coming up, an interview with Mike Davis, a social critic and UCI historian. First, we're going to look at some of the news updates, give you a news update of what's happening. Today's Washington Post is reporting that the CIA will be expanding and hiring more covert operatives to spy on Americans. That's all part of this war on terrorism. The new director of the CIA, who was a congressman from Florida, who replaced the previous director in September, is trying to prove that he can do the job. And so the number of spies is expected to increase by 50%. In addition, this agencies are now trying to argue that they should be able to do more to spy on Americans. And in addition, the Pentagon wants to be able to talk to American citizens without revealing that they are spying for the government. So there's a huge expansion underway of the intelligence agencies. In terms of events locally, there will be a protest coming up next week at Santa Ana, in Santa Ana, on October 22nd at the corner of Bristow and McFadden. There will be local events in connection with the national anti-police brutality protests, which is on October 22nd nationally, at 12 noon at the corner of Bristow and McFadden in Santa Ana, I believe. There will be people gathering. The leaflet says, "Stand united against acts of inhumanity committed by police against the citizenry." And it's endorsed by Asians for Jericho and Mumia, the Alliance Working for Asian Rights and Empowerment, the UCI Asian Pacific Student Association, APSA, and this radio show. On October 27th, U.S. Ambassador to Vietnam, Ambassador Marine, will be visiting UC Irvine to provide a general overview of the state of bilateral relations with Vietnam as Vietnam tries to join the WTO, and next year's APEC meeting is in Hanoi, which President Bush will be attending. So that will happen on October 27th next week, in 2 weeks, at 10:30 a.m. at the Cross Cultural Center conference room. Michael Marine, the U.S. ambassador to the Socialist Republic of Vietnam, will be on campus. At UCLA this coming Thursday, on the 20th, from 6 to 10 p.m., a writer for the Revolution magazine and author of Maoist Economics and the Revolutionary Road to Communism, Raymond Lauder, will be speaking on why he thinks socialism is much better than capitalism. Raymond Lauder at UCLA at Haynes Hall, A18, on Thursday at 6 o'clock in Los Angeles. This show first started in 1993, and our first edition was an interview with the brother of an activist who was assassinated in Santa Ana, a Palestinian activist who had been assassinated in Santa Ana. And this week saw the announcement that the FBI is renewing calls for this 1985 killing of Alex Ode, who was an educator in Santa Ana. It's an unsolved crime. There are suspicions that certain people were involved, but they were never arrested. And so Alex Ode, who was the Western Regional Director of the Arab of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, was killed October 11, 1985, when a bomb exploded in his Santa Ana office. So it was considered the first act of domestic terrorism in the United States, the recent domestic terrorism. And so FBI now is still investigating and has just this past week renewed a call for tips on this murder. And we interviewed the brother of Alex Oda on our first show back in September 1993. Today we're going to airing an interview with Mike Davis, who's a historian here at UC Irvine, and he's the author of a new book which has just come out called The Monster at Our Door: The Global Threat of Avian Flu. This is published by New Press in New York, and the website is www.thenewpress.com if you want more information about this book. Mike Davis is a MacArthur Fellow, one of the so-called Genius Awards recipients, and is the author of several books, including City of Quartz, Ecology of Fear, Lake Victorian Holocaust, Dead Cities, and with Kelly Mayhew and Jim Miller, Under the Perfect Sun. He hails from San Diego. So we asked Mike Davis to talk about his, not just his book, but about his recent trip to New Orleans, where he went down to document the aftermath of governmental neglect and racism in that city in the aftermath of Katrina. And so we will air this interview with him right now. This is Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. This is Dan Zhang, your host. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. We're going to play you this interview with Mike Davis, which was recorded earlier.
Welcome to Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. With us today is Mike Davis, a professor of history here at Irvine, and activist and a scholar. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you.
I understand you just went down to New Orleans and looked at the situation down there.
Yes, I spent 4 days in New Orleans and also 4 days in southwestern Louisiana. I actually got trapped there when Hurricane Rita hit the coast.
And is the situation worse than you expected?
Well, within New Orleans itself, the situation was very strange because the government was claiming, for instance, that the Army Corps of Engineers was working night and day to repair levees. And so you had this expectation of very high levels of activity. And in fact, the city was largely deserted, except for little survival communities of people, soup kitchens, some very interesting community-based efforts going on. But in terms of the state, the government role, apart from attempts to restore electricity, in 2 days, I saw almost nothing going on. There is, of course, a surplus of heavily armed federal police agencies of all kinds, most of whom ended up hanging on the French Quarter, where they got free jambalaya and beer. But you couldn't really say that the federal government, the state, or anybody else was actually working night and day to restore the vital infrastructures in the city. And this was particularly true in the worst-hit areas of mid-city eastern New Orleans and, of course, the Ninth Ward.
Is there a class kind of basis for what they're going to improve or redevelop or reconstruct? I mean, are they going to pick the richer areas to reconstruct first?
Well, New Orleans has been in the midst of a huge social struggle over redevelopment for almost a generation now, with the business elite, one of the most traditionally powerful and secretive in the entire country. Anybody who's read Barry's best-selling book, The Great Flood, has an image of what a powerful group of people the traditional elites are in New Orleans. They operate through something called the New Orleans Business Council, and they're basically the power behind the throne of the current mayor of New Orleans, Mayor Nagin. But for decades, they've essentially been fighting to create a continuous area of gentrified housing, tourist attractions running from the French Quarter along the Mississippi River's East Bank all the way to through the Garden District to the Tulane campus area. And they've been fighting essentially to reduce the number of poor people in the city. One of the most outrageous examples was the destruction of a famous public housing project called the St. Thomas Project in an area that's now known as the Warehouse District to make way for gentrified housing and a Walmart. So this design for the city, reducing the number of poor black people, of gentrification, of enlarging the infrastructure for tourism, this has been a master plan now for at least a generation. So it isn't surprising in the aftermath of this disaster that leadership should immediately be assumed by these groups. There's also an important political dimension here, too. Louisiana, of the states of the Deep South, the five really deep southern states, Louisiana is not exactly a blue state, but it has the most competitive politics. Unlike Mississippi, which is now solidly Republican, Louisiana, for instance, still has a Democratic senator and a Democratic governor. And this is almost solely due to the African-American Democratic vote in New Orleans. For instance, Marie Landrieu, who's the Democratic senator, won a tight race in 1996 with only 6,000 vote margin. And she got that because she carried New Orleans by 100,000 votes. Now, obviously, Karl Rove and other Republican strategists understand that if you somehow lose 10 or 15,000 active black voters in New Orleans, you utterly shift the balance of power within Louisiana. The Republicans gain immediately another senator, and you turn what's the kind of pinkish, or some people would call it a purple state, into a red state like Alabama or Mississippi. So the stakes are very high in New Orleans, both for local elites who've had this redevelopment vision for many years, and for the Republican Party.
In a piece for the Le Monde Diplomatique, you wrote about the kind of transfer of corporate kind of involvement from Iraq to New Orleans that you expect to happen with all the reconstruction. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, first of all, let me say that when you go to New Orleans, you are constantly running into people desperately looking for work, small businessmen, manual workers, people trying to cling to the city to keep their stake in the city, but in desperate need of jobs. And so far, there's been almost no effort to reemploy people. There's been no real debate about employing locals to rebuild New Orleans. Most of the people who've come in, the skilled workers, some of whom are housed on hugely expensive cruise ships moored to the city, are from out of state. There's even been a recent example of where local workers, unionized workers, were fired by the employer, brought in instead non-union employees from Texas. So a crucial issue in the recovery here is providing jobs for people, and that would ensure that people can stay in the area. And of course, your listeners know that the mayor had to lay off half the city workforce because the city's basically bankrupt. Now, all this contrasts in the most dramatic in shocking way with the fact that the federal government immediately gave hundreds of millions of dollars of prime contracts without bidding in a non-competitive process to Halliburton, the Shaw Group, which is the biggest corporation based in New Orleans, various security firms, all of whom are familiar to us from their disastrous and piratical role in Iraq. Not only that, but the person who now oversees the Army Corps of Engineers in southern Louisiana is the same guy who was in charge of bidding and reconstruction initially in Iraq. The former head of Homeland Security before Brown, the guy who actually appointed Brown, is all over Baton Rouge. He's now a lobbyist, and his role was to get these contracts to big private corporations as quickly as possible. So you've seen to a degree that I'd say must have surprised some people who thought they would have learned better by now, a kind of Baghdad syndrome in New Orleans at the same time that local people cannot find work. Just to give you another statistic, one of the mainstay small businesses in New Orleans, obviously, particularly in the black community, are small restaurants. And the Times-Picayune, New Orleans paper, estimated the other day that a third of the small restaurants, of the restaurants in the city, almost all small restaurants, had now collapsed and would not be, you know, reopened. So the government has rushed to reward its political base, huge contractors based in oil companies based in Texas and the South, while allowing New Orleans to go without jobs, allowing a huge amount of small business to become extinct, and now for city government to virtually collapse.
Do you believe that FEMA should not have been part of the Homeland Security, or should have been separated, kept separate at the beginning of all this?
Well, FEMA was really the showcase of the Clinton administration under DeWitt, Clinton's director of FEMA, who had cabinet rank. And of course, now we see that Homeland Security has been a huge blanket for awarding, with minimum public scrutiny or oversight, $1 million contracts to all kinds of people, generally Republican contributors, while at the same time weakening rather than increasing the safety of Americans in the face of natural disaster or, for that matter, of terrorism. And analog to what happened to FEMA, it's been the government's so-called biodefense or bioshield program, which is its official name. Washington has given billions of dollars in contracts toward the development of vaccines and treatments for hypothetical bioterrorist plagues like anthrax and Ebola fever. And in the beginning, some well-meaning people thought, well, some of this had to trickle down to public health and research and basic diseases, infectious diseases like influenza and tuberculosis. The opposite has happened. What's occurred instead is tuberculosis researchers have gone to where the money is, less
Sorry about that. Let's see what. Hang on. We'll try to fix this.
To save her neighborhood. She's a middle-aged African-American woman who saved the lives of several old people, ceaselessly going out trying to find things like ice for insulin, turned her yard into basically a refugee camp within the city, yet has faced the most incredible harassment. When she went to find ICE, she was actually thrown on the ground and abused by the National Guard for carrying a bag of ICE. The police had constantly threatened and harassed her. And part of it is just simply because you have so many of the wrong people, that is, so many heavily armed military and police types with nothing to do except to harass people who are desperately trying to take care of the poor, the infirm, and elderly people who remain inside the city. And we've heard complaints like this from virtually everybody we talk to remaining in the city, whether they were white artists in the Bywater or, you know, elderly African-American people in the lower Garden District.
How do you think the media is portraying? I know there was a picture of this white couple that had food, and they were described kind of as innocent, whatever. And then there was a black person with food, and then he or she was described as a looter.
Well, I actually spoke to a police officer, a relative of a friend of mine who was in the city, and he explained that the police, and he called them the good police, because there are a lot of bad police in New Orleans.
Sure.
He said the good police did the obvious rational thing. They told people to go into stores to take food and water and vital supplies, just right. like the police themselves opened up an auto dealership to get cars because their cars were drowned.
Submerged, yeah.
And although there probably has been some, real looting, some of it by the police themselves, almost all of what was depicted in the press, including people carrying cans of beer. I don't know what culture some of these news broadcasters come out of, but the culture I grew up with, beer is survival necessity when the temperature is 100 degrees and 100% humidity. Almost all of that had to do with the fact that the population was abandoned. For 4 days, the only people who went in to rescue people, the only people, aside from some courageous national Coast Guardsmen and their helicopters, were volunteers, many of them Cajun fishermen and hunters from southern Louisiana, hundreds of whom, answering a television appeal, towed their boats in the city, spent days saving people. FEMA's now taking credit for saving the majority of the people, and it's simply not true. People were abandoned simply to die for 4 days, and what you saw on TV was largely, people coping as best, they could. And we now understand that these stories of, George Romero, Night of the Living Dead type scenes in central New Orleans, there may have been a few incidents or two, are largely, the products of the imagination of politicians and the media. And one of the most disturbing things that's emerged is how the Pentagon claims the reason that and FEMA that they were so lax in responding, waited so long, is they were fearful of the violence, of this imaginary violence in the city. So there's no question that the media that reported these stories, the politicians, including Mayor Nagin, who endorsed them, are at least indirectly responsible for the death of people who weren't saved or relieved in a punctual way.
In the history of, anarchism in the U.S., there have been, and other places, there have been creations of self-help groups that came into being to kind of take care of things when the government fails. Do you see this as what happened there?
Yes. I mean, the story of Hurricane Katrina, in many ways, is the worst possible conspiracy of money and power not to save people and to deliberately drive people out of the city. On the other hand, anybody who has any doubts about ordinary blue-collar people in this country can only come back from southern Louisiana, greatly inspired. The example of so many, particularly people like the older women in the community who stayed behind to tend to even older and infirm people. The many accounts of gang members who actually became rescuers of the first resort. Artists in the city, bohemians, who either didn't leave or came back to the city. The Green Party, which has set up its own relief operation, far more effective than the Red Cross, from the city. But I think the most inspiring and least told story of all is simply how hundreds of just Louisiana fishermen, hunters, people that other people might regard as rednecks, took their boats in the city and spent days, sometimes the risk of their own life, rescuing people where the state failed, and how for every white suburb like Gretna across the river from New Orleans, which turned its back on the tragedy of people, actually the police barred the bridge and fired over the heads of people, for every example of racism like that, you have an example of somewhere like Ville Platte, which is a French-speaking white and black community which has taken in thousands of evacuees without regard, to their skin color. So you've seen, both, the worst of human nature in terms of, of racism and selfishness, but you've also seen the best. You've seen a capacity amongst ordinary, working-class southern Louisianans, to help themselves and fight for a way of life, which I must say is a different way of life from what most of us, a different kind of culture from what most of us has, because what poor people in New Orleans or in the parishes or in the bayou share together is a way of life that values community and family and celebration more highly than it does acquisitive individualism or consumption. In some ways, the opposite of the culture we live in here.
So, is there, as a historian, is this the first time it's happened like this in American history, or
a disaster of this magnitude? How would you compare to something that's happened before?
It was hard to think of a truly natural disaster in American history. Natural forces, destructive natural forces, have almost always followed the grain of poverty or inequality. In some cases, they've been directly caused by wealth, like in the famous Johnstown flood, when the reservoir, a dam at a resort of the richest people in Pennsylvania, the steel lords of Pittsburgh, broke and drowned people downstream. The responses to disasters have always been based on issues of race and class. What's different about this disaster is not just the magnitude of the suffering and the forced abandonment of an entire city. That's actually happened before in San Francisco and Galveston. But the ways in which I think that urban crisis, urban inequality, federal neglect of inner cities, the racial redlining of cities, the way that the urban crisis now coincides with the environmental crisis. And the result of this could be hundreds of thousands of people forced to leave the region, the destruction of a whole way of life. And New Orleans, to the extent that it's rebuilt, becoming a caricature of itself, a theme park where jazz and Zydeco and Cajun music are still played, but the root cultures that gave life and birth to these musics no longer exist or dispersed and live elsewhere in exile. This is what the stakes are, I think, in southern Louisiana.
It'll be like a new Disneyland down there or something.
Well, New Orleans, to some extent, already is a Disneyland, obviously. And, if you've spent time in Bourbon Street or watched the tourists in the Garden District. But the point is that it has depended on the very neighborhoods, the very people that it despises and are criminalized by the police and the civic leaders. That is, the working class, black neighborhoods in the former back swamp districts, like the 8th and 9th Ward or in mid-city. They're the soul of the city. They've generated the culture that people come to see. But it's now clear that unless something drastic is done, and there really is tremendous national solidarity to support the right of return, that many of these historic communities will no longer exist. People will be unable to return to the city for the absence of jobs and homes, not because of what other people are claiming, that they find life so much better in Salt Lake City or Houston. That's not the point.
It's because they can't come back, huh? Because
every day that goes by without providing shelter, near within New Orleans and providing employment, forces more people to make the decision to live elsewhere. And it's hard to believe that there isn't a deliberate... flocks, and they represent a very considerable investment to poor farmers, to peasants. Right now, the government compensates about 10% of the cost of destroying a flock. And so, naturally, people are reluctant to report sick birds. If they do report them, there's a tendency to eat them or sell them. And to make the effort effective, you need to be able to fully subsidize the destruction of the flock. This is a trivial amount of aid for rich countries. It's a large amount of money for Vietnam, and it has been opposed by U.S. livestock and poultry interests. They've opposed giving aid, which they claim is economic, not public health aid, to Vietnam. Vietnam is right now, remains still, the front line in the world struggle against the emergence of pandemic influenza, and the effort falls short, not primarily because of the Vietnamese themselves, but from the failure of, above all, the United States, which is the greatest moral obligation to Vietnam, to provide relatively small amounts of economic and scientific support.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking with Mike Davis, historian here at UC Irvine, and who has just come back from New Orleans. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Great. Thanks. So that was Mike Davis here
being interviewed earlier on Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. You're listening to this public affairs show that it's the last time it's on this day, and we'll take a hiatus, a break for 2 weeks, and then we'll come back on Monday at 9 a.m. Monday at 9 a.m. On KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Our show website is kuci.org, and you can go there and see the see links to articles that Mike has written on the situation in New Orleans that were published in The Nation and elsewhere, as well as in Le Monde Diplomatique, in the English edition of that. So if you go to kuci.org -tilde DTSANG, you can see that information. Some of the articles include, and we'll take a look at it, some of the articles on that that are linked there include 25 questions about the murder of New Orleans, and another one on melting away about climate change. On the 25 questions of the murder of New Orleans, Mike Davis and Anthony Fortinel both spent this time in New Orleans, and he has these 25 questions. He and his colleague has these 25 questions. Why did the flood wars along the 17th Street Canal only break on the New Orleans side and not on the Metairie side? Was this the result of neglect and poor maintenance by New Orleans authorities? Number two, who owned the huge barge that was catapulted through the wall of the Industrial Canal, killing hundreds in the Lower Ninth Ward, the most deadly hit-and-run accident in U.S. history? Number three, all of New Orleans and St. Bernard Parish, east of the Industrial Canal, were drowned, except for the Elm Monaster Michoud Industrial District along Chef Monteur Highway. Why was industrial land apparently protected by stronger levees than nearby residential neighborhoods? Number four, why did Mayor Ray Nagin, in defiance of his own official disaster plan, delay 12 to 24 hours in ordering a mandatory evacuation of the city? And number five of these questions, 25 questions that Mike Davis and his colleague asked: why did Secretary of Homeland Security Michael Chertoff not declare Katrina an incident of national significance until August 31st, thus preventing the full deployment of urgently needed federal resources? And number six, why wasn't the nearby USS Bataan immediately sent to the aid of New Orleans? The huge amphibious landing ship had a state-of-the-art 600-bed hospital, water and power plants, helicopters, food supplies, and 1,200 sailors eager to join the rescue effort. And number seven, similarly, why wasn't the Baltimore-based hospital ship USS Comfort ordered to sea until August 31st, or the 82nd Airborne Division deployed in New Orleans until September 5? And number eight, why does Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld balk at making public his severe weather execution order that established the ground rules for the military response to Katrina? Did the Pentagon, as a recent report by the Congressional Research Service suggests, fail to take initiatives within already authorized powers, then attempt to transfer the blame to the state and local governments? And number nine, why where the more than 350 buses of New Orleans Regional Transportation Authority eventually flooded where they were parked, not mobilized, to evacuate the infirm, poor, and carless residents. And number 10, what significance attaches to the fact that the chair of the Transportation Authority, appointed by Mayor Nagin, is Jimmy Rice, the wealthy leader of the New Orleans Business Council, which has long advocated a thorough redevelopment and cleanup of crime in the city. And so that goes on. You can check this link to this Nation article by Mike Davis and Jim and by Mike Davis and Anthony Fortino, 25 questions about the murder of New Orleans on the Subversity website, kuci.org/tildeDTSANG. We're going to look at also take a look at the book that he wrote, Monster at Our Door, and we'll read you a little excerpt from it to give you a taste of his analysis of this pandemic on avian flu. This is a book that has just come out from the New Press in New York. And he has one chapter on called Plague and Prophet. And he's talking about a powerful conglomerate. He says, chickens are likewise at the bottom line of Asia's largest and most powerful agricultural export conglomerate, the Bangkok-based Sharong Pophand, CP, or as it is universally known, figures centrally in the story of H5N1's terrifying return, and that's the name for the avian flu, in the winter of 2003 and 4, and the unprecedented HPAI epidemic that threatens to become a global human and ecological cataclysm. Founded by the immigrant Xie brothers from Guangdong, CP was a rice seed distributor in Bangkok's Chinatown until Chia Ek Chow, the youngest of four sons, took over the business in 1964. In the face of growing intolerance towards the Chinese diaspora throughout Southeast Asia, he changed the name to Danin Cheravano and reoriented the company to chicken breeding and broiler farming. Impressed by the success of U.S. companies in transforming poultry raising into a streamlined industrial process more closely resembling chemical manufacture than a traditional agriculture, Cheravano formed two successive strategic partnerships with American companies and became Asia's leading apostle of Tyson-style intensive farming and vertical integration. In 1973, Cheravano opened Thailand's first modern poultry slaughterhouse and began exporting to Japan. CP's major competitors, the Bangkok Livestock Trading Company and Saha Farms, were forced to keep pace with Cheravano's innovations, which included organizing networks of contract farms and building modern export plants, processing plants. And by the mid-1990s, Thailand, which had adopted CP's corporate slogan, Kitchen of the World, had the most corporatized livestock industry in Asia. CP and a handful of other vertically integrated exporters controlled 80% of production, with chicken farming concentrated in a dense, polluted belt 60 to 150 kilometers outside Bangkok. She's saying that the then he goes on to talk about the how they manage and this farm system, farming system, this kind of factory system, and how they make the profits. basically what he's saying, he quotes a journalist, Isabel Delforge, as saying that with contract farming, large companies control the whole production process. They lend money to the farmers, they sell them chicks, feed, and medicine, and they have the right to buy the whole production. But usually the company is not committed to buy the chickens if the demand is low. Contract farmers bear all the risks related to production and become extremely dependent on demand from the world market. They become factory workers in their own field. So what Mike Davis goes on to argue is that this industry has to expand, and so they do. They go. His ambition is to go back to bring his work back to China. This owner of this corporate farm in Thailand, Mike says, thanks to astute politicking and powerful Guangdong connections, CP was literally the first multinational investor to step foot inside Deng Xiaoping's open door in 1979. CP's foreign business license in Shenzhen was number 001. CP by itself, or in alliance with other capital groups, has subsequently invested billions in the PRC, the People's Republic of China. In addition to holding a diversified portfolio of hotels, shopping malls, fast food franchises, including Kentucky Fried Chicken, telecommunications and restaurants, it has built more than 100 feed mills and poultry processing plants throughout China in an attempt to forestall both foreign competitors, Tyson Foods above all, and local upstarts in the world's most dynamic market for chicken products. And he also goes on to argue that this type of growth in Thailand and China, this explosive growth, he calls it, has required massive amounts of what he calls political grease. In 1996, for example, the company made an illegal $250,000 donation to the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, which backfired, causing bad publicity for both CP and the Clinton administration when fundraiser John Huang was indicted. The right-wing American Spectator, Mike writes, pointed to CP's alliance with a leading Chinese weapon maker and complied that it was one of the front companies for Communist China that had been buying up and spying on the United States. But the magazine neglected to mention that a few months earlier, Neil Bush, George W.'s brother, had formed a joint venture company with Chevron. And as Dan Modia and David Cohen would later detail in The Nation, both the Bush family and the Carlyle Group, the private investment fund used by the family and other leading Republicans to turn insider access into gold, have long-standing and intimate business relations with the CP. Former President George H.W. Bush, for example, was reportedly paid $250,000 by CP to lobby as Asian and American leaders on its behalf. And so that's this is just some excerpts from the book, the new book by Professor Mike Davis, called The Monster at Our Door: The Global Threat of Avian Flu, a new book that actually came out before George Bush went before the media to argue that the U.S. should do something. And so this actually was an analysis that predated the efforts of the U.S. government now. Countries like Vietnam now are getting support. The donor agencies have just pledged about $17 million to help various countries in Southeast Asia, including Vietnam, to begin to meet this threat. So read this book to see, you might want to read this book to see what is behind this and why the U.S. has been lagging in helping and in confronting this issue of avian flu that started in Southeast Asia, but Today there was news that it has spread to Europe. In Turkey, avian flu was discovered this week. And so it's becoming eerily what maybe Mike Davis is predicting. You're listening to KUCI on 88.9 FM in Irvine. We can do a little show promo here. Let's see if we can. Well, coming up, there will be coming up in 2 weeks. We will have another show here on KUCI, and it would be. We would this time slot will revert back to Piece by Piece with Sarah Pauley, and we would start at the new time at 10 a.m. on Monday mornings, starting with October 31st. So that's our new schedule for the rest of the quarter. We will go in hiatus for a couple of weeks and then return on a Monday instead of this Friday, where we have been alternating with Piece by Piece on this time slot that you're listening to today. Hopefully this will settle down and we will be able to stick to this schedule. We will let's see we would keep going here, and this is Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Coming up, there's some films on campus at the Film and Video Center. Next week, we'll be showing High School documentarian Frederick Weissman's breakthrough debut. A film that came after the debut film of Titicket Follies, which was a portrait of Bridgewater State Prison for the criminally insane. And after that, he made High School, which UCI Irvine will be showing at the Film and Video Center next Thursday at 7 o'clock. And that's on the campus of UC Irvine at 7 o'clock, pioneering a film about high school life. And on October 27th, there will be a film presentation of the films of Kim So-young, who's a director and active filmmaker since 1964, and teaches in the Cinema Studies Department of Korean National University. She will be showing a couple of films, one called Koryu, Southern Women, addressing the issues of women's modes of expression and existence in both pre-modern and modern Korea. I'll be seeing her, a documentary on women in Korean cinema that deliberately eschews the traditional modes of documentary filmmaking. So that's on the 27th of October at 7 p.m. So check out the schedule of this film center here at UC Irvine. On the web, it's www.humanities.uci.edu/FVC. And you can call 949-824-7418 for information about admission to these films. 949-824-7418, the UCI Film and Video Center. To continue with announcements, the National Anti-Police Brutality Protests will happen on October 22nd at the corner of Bristol and McFadden in Santa Ana. And that's an annual event, national event, protesting police brutality. So if So that's organized by a group of local activists, including and co-sponsored by this show. So hope you can be involved in activities relating to this issue. And so that's on October 22nd at noon at the corner of Bristol and McFadden. There'll also be an election coming up, and you might have seen a union organizer from UCAFT, from the California University Council, American Federation of Teachers on campus, distributing literature and also registration material on the Ring Road in the beginning, Monday through Thursday, I believe, on Ring Road near the Red Cross van. So check that out if you are interested in finding more information about the upcoming special elections here in California that the governor is pushing. Let's see if we can run this notice here. We will be continuing on the show in 2 weeks. We will come back in 2 weeks, but we will be here on a different day, on Monday at 9 a.m. here on Subversity. If you want back to listen to earlier shows from last few years or even earlier, you can go to our Subversity website here on KUCI.org/TildeDTSANG and listen to the other radio programs that have aired on this station.
Today, in a world of sound bites and constant visual stimulation telling us how to look, act, talk, and feel, we have lost our ability to connect. Instead of focusing on what celebrities are doing as if they were our acquaintances, maybe we can look more to each other to emulate and learn from. Join us Friday mornings from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. with Peace by Peace, where we discuss issues that affect our peace, peace of humanity, and peace in our time.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them and ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays at 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Piece by Piece is actually, will air again on Friday, replacing this show, which would migrate to Monday at 9 a.m. Starting October 31st. So we will go off on hiatus for a couple of weeks and resume October 31st at 9 a.m. here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Mike Davis on the website. Also, from the KUCI Subversity website, which is kuci.org to the DTSANG, has put up we've put up a bunch of his articles there. And among the other questions that he asked in his co-written piece, 25 Questions About the Murder of New Orleans, he also asked, under what authority did Mayor Nagin meet confidentially in Dallas with the 40 thieves, white business, so-called 40 thieves, white business leaders, reportedly to discuss the triaging of poorer black areas and a corporate-led master plan for rebuilding the city. And number 12, everyone knows about a famous train called the City of New Orleans. Why was there no evacuation by rail? Was Amtrak part of the disaster planning? If not, why not? And why were patients at a private hospitals like Tulane evacuated by helicopter while their counterparts at the charity hospital were left to suffer and die? And number 14, was the failure to adequately stock food, water, and portable toilets, cots, and medicine at the Louisiana Superdome a deliberate decision, as many believe, to force poorer residents to leave the city? And number 15, the French Quarter has one of the highest densities of restaurants in the nation. Once the acute shortage of food and water at the Superdome and the Convention Center were known, why didn't officials requisition supplies from hospitals and restaurants located just a few blocks away? As it happens, vast quantities of food were simply left to spoil. So there's some of the questions that are being raised by Mike Davis and his colleague in this article in The Nation that's linked from our Subversity website. If you want to listen to the an archive of this of interviews with Mike Davis, he was last on Subversity in 2 years ago talking about the anti-war movement when he was interviewed by a professor Stefano Sensi, a visiting researcher here at UC Irvine, neurologist and activist. And that show is on the Subversity Real Audio Archive at kuci.org/tsang. So check those out. As announced earlier, there will be a visit by the U.S. ambassador to Vietnam to UC Irvine on the 27th of October at 10:30 at the Cross Cultural Center. You could ask him questions about the avian flu pandemic that started in Vietnam or maybe even started elsewhere, but had the largest effect, killing the most people in Vietnam since it happened last year, or a little bit earlier. So the U.S. ambassador to Vietnam, Ambassador Marine, will be coming to UC Irvine on Thursday, October 27th, in 2 weeks. We won't be here for 2 weeks. We will resume at another time slot at 9 a.m. on Mondays, starting October 31. So we look forward to hearing from you and from your feedback on this show. You can write to subversity@kuci.org, and we are going to right now coming up is the Enlightenment Project here on KUCI. Tani Tenuvio is sitting in for Ed, who is the usual host, I guess, of the show. We're going to break for some music. This is Subversity here on KUCI. This is KUCI 88.9 in Irvine. The opinions expressed on